time for This Week in Chicago History, sponsored by UChicagoMedicine.org. Good morning, Anna DeVontis. We start out with
morning,
some Chicago
Bob.
TV history, don't we?
We do. A station you and I have both worked for and love, 1955, WTTW went on the air. And, you know, it started by civic leaders, Bob. You know, they wanted this to be about education. There was an educational focus at first. It was WTTW, we all know, stands for Window to the World, and they wanted to bring the world to you. The first show, Report to Teachers, was just part of a huge slate of educational programming in the daytime hours. Does anyone remember? Anyone take a course? You could take college courses for credit on WTTW, which is super cool. Mm-hmm. Way back when. Think about that, you know? And then they had the quality children's programming. They blazed quite a trail in the beginning, became the most watched PBS station in the country. Still is, I believe. By its first anniversary, they had done the first remote broadcast from Orchestra Hall, the first language course, first series in income tax preparation. They had set up that partnership with Chicago's Board of Ed and did that TV college series. If you just think about how they were thinking back then, because, you know, now we have the internet and everyone connects through to education that way, but back then they were doing it through the television, which is pretty cool if you think about it.
And of course, the pledge breaks and the auction. Remember the auction?
Marty Robinson. Remember him?
Yeah, that's right. Where is my tote bag? I think when they threw me out of there, they did give me a tote bag.
We were so proud of those in our household. The tote bags, the mugs, all of it. It was so cool. All of us have our favorite WTTW shows over the years. We pulled a clip here, Bob, that will everyone remember the Friday Night Show starring Bob Surratt? This is a clip of a not so well-known at the time politician, Barack Obama, and you sitting down. It's just an amazing interview.
You wrote something interesting in your book about those days on the South Side as a community organizer. You referred to yourself as a reluctant skeptic, doubtful of your own motives, having too many quarrels with God to accept a salvation too easily won. Now, this sounds like a very frustrated guy, and for somebody who everyone says, and I know it's true, has a great sense of humor now, man, could you lighten up back then or not?
You know, I was very serious. When I was in New York in my last couple years of college, my mother used to tease me and call me Gandhi, you know, because I had I had two plates and two towels and, you know, didn't have a television set.
Minimalist.
I was just an ascetic. And part of it was, I think, having to kind of burn off a lot of excess that I'd gone through. You know, I went through my wild times when I was in high school. You know, I think I overcompensated by just becoming deadly serious during those late college years, you know, the years that I was organizing. And, you know, people would invite me to parties and I'd say, what are you talking about? We've got a revolution that has to take place.
Guys, huh?
You know, yeah, just real, way too somber.
Whatever happened to that Barack Obama guy?
Boy, that interview, I got to say, go back and look at it. It's in its entirety on the WTTW site. And it's, I don't know, there's something about that.
I appreciate that.
Very good conversation.
This week in 2004, the Bean was finally completed, wasn't it?
Cloudgate, as is officially known. Mm-hmm. The Bean is what we call it in Chicago, but it debuted in Millennium Park. There had been this big unveiling for the Millennium Park opening, but the Bean wasn't ready yet. So it took a few months, and it was finally welded together and put together, and it was in September when it was finalized. Indian-born artist Anish Kapoor is behind it. He envisioned this sculpture that would reflect back onto the city, Bob, capture the skyline, the lake in the reflection. And, you know, he created this thing that has created so much buzz over the years. It's a tourist stop for sure, but I think even us locals, we like to go over there and check out the Bean. Quick backstory, though, Bob. A lot of people don't know. Originally, Jeff Koons, the famous American artist, was going to design something for Millennium Park. He wanted to do this 90-foot slide that you could actually slide down as you took in the city. That got scrapped because it wasn't handicapped accessible. There were some safety concerns, and so they commissioned Kapoor to do the Bean.
Didn't know about that plan, and everybody loves looking at their reflections in the Bean, don't they?
So true.
Candy history in this town, there's a lot of it. Tell us what happened back in 1921.
Okay, I didn't know this one, Bob. I don't know about you. The Baby Ruth candy bar, born in Chicago. 1921. Otto Schneering, the Curtis Candy Company, that name may be familiar to a lot of people, started on North Clark Street in the back of a hardware store. You know, this was the time when they were mass producing candy bars for the first time, and Hershey's was taking off, but they really only had the single ingredient, or maybe the ones with nuts, chocolate bars with nuts. And Otto went into his back room and just started experimenting with just about anything you can put in a candy bar, from marshmallows to nougat to, you know, you name it, coconut, everything. And he started selling all these different varieties, and the Baby Ruth, you know, version, go figure, took off. So that was the birth of it all. And so there you go.
Always a controversy about who the candy bar was named after, right?
This is either one of the greatest scams or the greatest misunderstandings of all time, because he says the owner and the guy who started Baby Ruth said he didn't name it after Babe Ruth, that had nothing to do with it. He said that it was Grover Cleveland's daughter, young daughter Ruth, who had visited his plant, his candy company. Mm-hmm. Never stood up to the light, though, the facts, Bob, because she wasn't a little kid at that time. She was actually almost in her 50s by that point, they figured out. And and Babe Ruth was a huge star, and so he kind of, you know, kind of got to use the name of a famous athlete without having to pay him for it.
So, okay, right.
There you go.
Named Daisy, she almost drives me crazy. I got a gal named Daisy.
Can't you just see the old microphone there? This week in Chicago history, Anna, talk about what happened in 1929.
Bob, Elvis sure sounds great in front of a Shure microphone. Can't you hear it there? The Shure brothers, they set up shop in the cities on the city's west side, 1929, and their name, as you know, has been synonymous with quality ever since, still to this day. Back in the 30s and 40s, that microphone became the gold standard for quality and entertainment and broadcasting. Also, the military, they contracted with Shure to use the microphone. So if you saw a U.S. general or a dignitary in front of a mic at some big event during World War II, it was likely a Shure microphone. If you saw Bob Hope performing before the troops overseas, that was likely a Shure microphone. And Elvis was so photographed in front of that, I think it's the Model 55 Unidyne Shure, that it became known as the Elvis mic. And it's still like that iconic, it's being reproduced now as to look retro. It's one of those microphones that just really has stood the test of time. People like it. Even now, Bob, a new generation of audiophiles have discovered Shure. If you go to its webpage and the company's history, club DJs and podcasters are now using them because they're still known for such quality. So there you go, here, headquartered in Niles now.
Yeah, that building in West Tui, it's really cool looking place.
It is.
Started right here. Let's move to 1954 and talk about what happened just about on this date in 54.
That's right, Bob. The Museum of Science and Industry dedicated the exhibit that remains one of the most popular to this day, the U-505 submarine. And to say that it was challenging to get that sub here would be a huge understatement. It was captured in a heroic military operation by American Navy troops during World War II. That German sub had been responsible for sinking 8 U.S. warships, and it was a huge target for the military. They wanted that submarine, but they had been stalking it for months. And the Navy said they wanted it out of commission, but here's the official order from the top. They said, capture the sub, don't destroy it. And you can think about how difficult that would be to do. Disable it enough to gain control of it, you know, get the Germans to surrender or surface it, but not blow it up, not damage it too much. Somehow they did it. Here is one of the Navy veterans who was there and boarded that sub when they captured it. He was speaking at the Museum of Science and Industry for the 75th anniversary.
The Chatelaine made the run and dropped the depth charges, got lucky, hit the screws in the back of the sub. Water started coming into the sub, and the submarine, the Germans, thought the sub was going to sink. So the captain of the sub ordered the sub to surface and for the men to abandon the sub.
And I've heard stories over the years about how wild it was to see the submarine. I guess it was coming down Lakeshore Drive or something. They were pulling it down the drive to get it to the museum. Can you imagine seeing that?
You can only imagine just what they went through to physically get it there, and what a day that must have been, and how that must have felt. You know, you think about it. They didn't just capture a submarine, Bob, but they also were able to get German intelligence. They were able to get German codes, and the Germans thought they sank it. They thought they destroyed it. So they didn't know for many months that they were intercepting communications. So pivotal moment in the war.
Yeah. and everybody still loves to see the U-505 at the museum. Mm-hmm. And now for celebrity birthdays this week in Chicago history.
Bonnie Hunt. You must have interviewed Bonnie Hunt a number of times.
Yes. Yeah, she's really, really a sweet person. And she loves talking about spending time working. I'm trying to remember if it was Tasty Freeze or Dairy Queen. But she did that.
Such humble roots.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That's the thing about her, and she seems like one of those people, Bob, who's not affected by Hollywood. She still seems like a great Chicago girl and or lady. You know, she's just incredible, so down to earth. One of seven kids, grew up in going to Catholic schools. Her dad was an electrician, mom a homemaker. She wanted to be a nurse and was actually working as an oncology nurse at Northwestern Memorial Hospital when she started an improv troupe on the side. Then auditioned for Waitress Sally, the role of Waitress Sally in Rain Man. I don't remember that exactly, but she was in it. She did it on her lunch break, and she won the role. And then it was off to Second City, more movie roles. She partnered with David Letterman for her talk show, The Bonnie Hunt Show. And they still remain friends to this day. So pretty cool just to see her whole success story.
And we should also mention, born on this day in 1950, Bill Murray. Happy birthday to him, wherever he is.
Happy birthday, Bill.
Hey, try to find him. Just try. Thanks, Anna. Talk to you
Thanks,
again
Bob.
Next Wednesday.